Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today we're talking about Overwatch, the video game that is slowly killing my relationship. For those of you who don't know, Overwatch is a first-person shooter video game released by Blizzard. You can get it on Xbox, PS4, or just the PC computer. It is a hero-based shooter game with a large cast of unique characters, and they all have their own unique abilities. It's also Blizzard's first new IP that's intellectual property in 17 years since the release of StarCraft. Now, in Overwatch, you go online in teams of six, or you'll go online and you'll join a team of six randomly, and you're up against another team of six, and what you try to do in this game is try and capture or control certain objectives, or keep people out of certain objectives. And there's 23 heroes as of now, 23 characters that you can play as, and they're all divided into four categories. You've got your attack heroes, your defense heroes, your tank heroes, and your support heroes. And just, they're all really cool in their own right, but I'm just going to mention a few here. You've got on attack, one of them is Genji, who's a cyborg ninja, half man, half machine.
Need he say more?
Need I say more? And he can jump around the map. He's got throwing stars and a magic spirit dragon-powered samurai sword that he can pull out and just chop people up with. Also, his brother is in the game, Hanzo, who has a bow, and he can shoot all these different kinds of arrows, and he can also shoot a spirit dragon arrow. There's also Mei, who's a Chinese woman who was frozen. She was cryogenically frozen for too long, and she wakes up 30 years later. But she's got this ice gun, and she can, like, freeze people with it, and she can shoot icicles. She can build a wall, an ice wall, to block people out or block damage. There's a lot.
I'm going to let you do this, because I think you have a lot more enthusiasm for it than I do.
There's just a lot of very cool characters with very different abilities. Claire will be talking about... What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the history of multiplayer gaming and online gaming, and kind of the two of them combined.
Yes, because Overwatch can only be played online, really. You can't really...
Yeah.
I mean, there's like training modes, but...
Yeah, that's not the real thing. And you have to play with other people.
And you have to play with other people, yes. And I'll be talking about Blizzard, a little background on the company, and then kind of how Overwatch was reborn, or not reborn, but was born out of the ashes of a failed Blizzard game. So Claire, take it away.
I'm going to start with multiplayer gaming because that came first, and then later online gaming, and the two kind of helped each other from there.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to do the whole history of video games because that's a lot more than I have time for. I'm going to start in 1973 when Atari, which is one of the first video game systems, sold the first real electronic video game called Pong.
Pong!
Yeah, yay. For $1,095, which was a lot of money.
That is a lot of money.
And like I said, the concept of video games wasn't new. Other companies had dabbled in making them, but this was the first really successful one. And these were arcade machines. And they started popping up in bars and in shopping malls. And they spawned other video games from other countries because it was so successful.
Yeah.
And then in the late 70s, chain restaurants, like I remember from being a kid, all around the U.S. started to install arcade games. And that's where multiplayer competition started. Players could record their highest scores with their initials. Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
I never got on that.
I don't think I ever got on that either. I think my brother Ryan probably did, though. It also makes me think of that Seinfeld episode where George is trying to save his Frogger high score because he knows he's never going to have a kid, and that's the only thing.
That's his legacy.
It's going to be his legacy.
Yeah, but that's how people started interacting playing video games.
Yeah.
And then, along with that, multiplayer gaming continued to grow because two people started to be able to play on the same screen and against each other. So that's the beginnings of multiplayer gaming.
Competition.
Yeah,
big
time competition.
Together, tearing them apart.
So the first example of players competing on separate screens is in 1973 with a game called Empire by Play-Doh. And this is where you try to take over the galaxy. It was played on computers.
Okay.
So you could play it you could only really play it at large organizations like universities because only they could afford to have the computers to connect to each other, to do that. Because it was the 70s time. And computers weren't as... everywhere.
Yeah, no, they weren't. They weren't nearly as powerful.
They weren't in our pockets either.
Like the computer that we have in our cars is more powerful than the computer they sent you know, the space shuttle into space.
So crazy. Like, just how fast it happens, too. Because in my head, I wasn't around then, but the 70s isn't that far away.
Yeah.
In 1980, a game called Space Invaders came out for the Atari VCS. And this is the game that's kind of credited for getting people really excited about video games. And people started buying consoles for their homes. And it became mainstream.
It also inspired that terrible Adam Sandler movie, Pixels.
Oh, is that inspired by Space Invaders?
Well, that's one of the games that really.
I didn't see it.
Don't.
Okay. Everyone don't see it. Well, the gaming community blossomed, and it led to a gaming boom. This led to a gaming crash. And that happened in the early 1980s.
Really? There was a bubble and a crash of
really
video
quick.
Games in the 80s?
Yeah, in the early 80s. All in the early 80s.
It was a very small bubble.
Well, but what happened was that Atari's success led to market saturation because so many gaming consoles popped up. And there were too few interesting games to go with the consoles.
Gotcha. They were all like different versions of the Atari games anyway, most of them.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Or like it was like, oh, we can make money with this.
Yeah.
But like they're not taking the time
to make a good
to
game.
To make good games. But because of how saturated the market was and the crash, a lot of good ideas got lost. There was technology developed for the Atari 2600 that got unveiled in 1982 called the CBC Game Line, and it was dabbling in online gaming in 1982, where it allowed users to download software and games using telephone connections and cartridges that could be plugged into the Atari console.
Oh, wow.
But it didn't gain support from leading game manufacturers at the time, so the people who were actually making the game didn't get it or weren't into it.
Yeah.
And the crash dealt it a death blow.
Gotcha.
Mattel, the toy company, also tried to enter the online gaming market in 1981 with something called Play Cable, which was a game download service provided by local cable companies. But the software was too demanding. It became too demanding and the device couldn't handle it. So it was discontinued in 2 years. So it's all these like really interesting ideas that were happening, but there just wasn't the support behind it.
Yeah, there wasn't the technology for it quite yet.
I think they could have developed the technology. It just, the games weren't popular enough. So they didn't have the focus on it that they would have needed.
Nerdism wasn't as big of a thing in the early 80s. You know, it wasn't as prevalent.
Or there just wasn't the internet to spread the nerdism.
I guess maybe that's what it is.
In the 80s also, home computers became affordable. They had much more powerful processors, and they opened the door to more complex, less linear games. And some of the early computers, actually, ironically, Macs, let users connect their devices so you could play with other players, like in the early 70s I was talking about. But instead of having to be at a university, you could do
just
it at home.
Do it at home.
Yeah.
It's a big deal, man.
Gaming from your own home.
Yeah.
In the early 90s, multiplayer gaming over the internet became much more popular. There were a few games that contributed to this, but the big one was called Pathway to Darkness, which was released in 1993. And this is where the player is a special forces soldier trying to stop a powerful godlike being from destroying the world. It coincided with the development of LAN parties, and this is where people with compatible game consoles, so like computers, Nintendos, had a gathering over a local area network or LAN, and they could play a multiplayer game that way. So it allowed fans to compete and interact from different rooms, different places. And with Pathway to Darkness as an example, you could either work together in the game as a team or you could fight each other.
I remember LAN parties quite well.
Oh yeah, I didn't participate in LAN parties. I was gaming by myself.
While the cool kids were making out with pretty girls, some of us were in basements playing Age of Empires.
Making
over
out
LAN
with pretty
parties.
Girls online.
Not even. We were playing as the Aztecs or the Spanish or the Britons.
It probably was better. Better time.
Maybe. Tell that to 13-year-old Kyle.
More advances in online gaming came with the release of the fourth generation consoles. So you have your Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis in the early 90s. And this is after the internet became public domain. So Nintendo released Satellaview, which allowed users to download games, news, cheat hints directly to their console using satellites.
What?
Yeah, and apparently it was really well supported.
In When was this?
In the 90s, but this tech never made it out of Japan, which is why you never had it.
Japan? What? I thought, when I was a kid, I thought they were in the future.
They were in the future.
I thought they were, and they are.
I had a Japanese friend growing up, and when she came back from Japan, the future came to me.
I was like, why would anyone in Japan move to dumb America?
Yeah, she had the best toys.
We're still playing on stupid Ataris. They're getting video games beamed to them via satellites.
Yeah, Japan
we
got
just
it.
Just got that.
Sega also had the Sega Channel service for Genesis, the Sega Genesis, in the mid-90s. And they launched it with Time Warner and telecommunications. And it's really cool. It sounds like something we would have now. It was made so customers could rent games over the cable network. For a monthly fee and an activation charge, subscribers could download and play a bunch of games through an adapter that connected to the console cartridge slot and hooked up to the cable TV.
That is way, way ahead of its
time.
Yeah,
super cool, right? And you could rent existing Genesis games and you could sample upcoming releases.
That's
so
insane.
Cool.
That's almost like an app store.
Yeah.
Or like the game section of your app store.
It's the beginning of the app store. And it was highly praised by critics. But a lot of cable companies failed to see the platform's potential, so they didn't carry it. And its user base was too low for Sega to continue with it. And I've always known the cable companies were evil, and this really proves it.
They are definitely evil.
They're the worst. Talking to you, Time Warner.
Or Comcast. You too.
So let's move on from Time Warner. A company called Catapult Entertainment was one of the first companies to attempt to bring online gaming to the masses with the X-Band gaming network. So it was for Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis owners, and they could play together online through a dial-up modem. I guess you couldn't talk on the phone. You were playing online. It was the very first of its kind. You could send X-mails. You could engage in online chat. But they had poor support from game publishers, and there wasn't a good library of compatible games, so it got canceled.
It seems like they were trying for online games or multiplayer games like over and over, but there just wasn't the
people don't
infrastructure,
get it.
And people didn't
people
get it.
People just didn't get it. Yeah, my hypothesis for this segment would be, look how hard they tried.
And we just now got how big this is.
Yeah, and then only recently.
Yeah.
So the Sega Dreamcast was a really big deal for online gaming. And funny enough, it was the console that broke Sega. Yeah. But it was the world's first internet-ready console to get a worldwide release in 2000. So what made it special is it came with a modem embedded in it and a copy of Planet Web Browsers with it, which basically the internet-based gaming was part of it rather than something that you would add on to it.
So it's like what the Xbox 360 or PS3 were.
It paved the way for that, yes. But here's the thing. Accessing the internet was expensive in 2000, and Sega was actually paying for it, for their users to use the internet, and they couldn't afford it.
Aw, poor Sega.
Yeah, so it was a really good idea.
We used to make fun of all the kids with Dreamcasts. Now I feel bad.
Look how mean you were. They were trying.
You can't even play Final Fantasy on your Dreamcast.
Because they were paying for everything.
They were playing Phantasy Star Online. That's what they were playing.
Yeah, which was supposed to be really cool.
Well, yeah, apparently it was amazing.
So this paved the way, like I said, for the next generation of consoles like Xbox and Xbox Live, which is the Xbox's internet,
their online service.
Their internet. Basically just picked up where Sega left off. Really quick wrap up. Since the early 2000s, internet capabilities have gone way up and the cost of tech has gone way down. The internet is very accessible now and it's common, so it's easier for consoles and video games to be online. Online storefronts have actually changed the way people buy games, much like online shopping has changed the way we buy everything.
You never have to leave your home anymore. You just sit
in
your
basement
in
GameStop.
Your underwear, buy your games, buy your groceries.
And you can update them from your computer too, or your computer or your console.
Yeah.
And you can interact with others online now way easier than you used to be able to. 54% of gamers feel gaming helps them keep in contact with friends, and 45% use it to spend time with their family.
Whoa.
I do.
Yeah, I guess I technically qualify for that as well.
Yeah. And nowadays, most games have an online component that is more important than the player's offline objectives. So the online game is more important than whatever game you're playing offline.
Yeah, I mean, look at World of Warcraft, you know.
Look at Overwatch, which we're talking about.
No, this is true.
Well, that's my segment, Kyle. Let me hear about Blizzard.
Blizzard Entertainment is a company.
And oh, yeah?
They make video games.
Mm-hmm.
But they're pretty interesting, actually. In my personal opinion, they've made some of the best games ever and are still making great games. But they didn't start as Blizzard, actually. They actually started as a company called Silicone and Synapse.
Where are they based?
They're based out of California.
Okay, that makes sense.
And they didn't change. They didn't keep that name, Silicone and Synapse. They eventually turned into Blizzard. But they started as Silicone and Synapse in 1991, where Mike Morhaime and Alan Adham, oh, and a guy, Frank Pierce, they all met at UCLA and they formed this company. So the way that Mike Morhaime and Alan Adham met is actually really interesting, where they were both in a bunch of computer classes together, but they didn't really know each other that well. And Alan Adham had left his computer to go get a cup of coffee or something, or go to the bathroom. And Mike Morhaime turned around and was like, thought he'd be kind of cheeky and go on Alan's computer and change the password and then log him out of his computer.
Like you do
if you're just a big jerk. So Alan comes back to his computer, types in his password, and just keeps working. And Mike is like, wait, what the hell happened? And he turned around and he was like, hey, how'd you do that? And he was like, what do you mean? He's like, how'd you get into your computer? I changed your password. And he's like, what'd you change it to? He's like, I changed it to my password. It turns out they were using the exact same password.
Do we know the password?
It was Joe, apparently.
Very tricky.
This is before you had to put like exclamation points and numbers and like you had to have 20 characters or whatever.
The hackers weren't that good yet.
They weren't that good. They weren't that prevalent yet. So they went on to form this video game company, and Alan Adham actually says that as a kid, he either wanted to own a candy factory or make video games.
Those are solid career goals.
Solid choices. They started trying to recruit all these nerds around the California area. They really just wanted to work with people who wanted to make video games.
I'm from California, and there are a lot of nerds in California. Yeah. I'm just going to say that.
In the early 90s, I bet it was still the case.
It might be controversial.
But they wanted to work with people, not who were necessarily the most phenomenal programmers or whatever, but who wanted to make video games. So like I said, the company was founded in 1991, and they were originally hired on to work on other people's video games. Like, the first game they made was RPM Racing, and that was for the Super Nintendo. And they were actually the first American company to produce a game for the Super Nintendo. And RPM Racing eventually evolved into Rock and Roll Racing, which came out in 1994, and that won Game of the Year, Racing Game of the Year.
Yeah, that was a little bit before I was playing video games. I don't know that game.
I was seeing some screenshots and some videos of it being played, and I was like, oh, I remember seeing you. Maybe it's just that a lot of the cars look the same back then on those old,
One car game. Yeah. You've seen one, you've seen them all.
Rock and Roll Racing was kind of, quote unquote, innovative in that Blizzard was like, all right, we'll make a racing game, but we're gonna make these laser cars and spaceships, and we're gonna make them race on the moon and stuff like that, and they're gonna have guns and missiles. And Rock and Roll Racing also had probably the first rock and roll soundtrack to a racing game, where they took these old rock songs and kind of made like a chiptune version of them and put them in a game. And because they're like, all the other racing games at the time had these lame soundtracks. If you're going to race in a car,
you need to feel cool.
You got to be listening to rock and roll.
Mm.
And I was like, Blizzard, you are men after my own heart. And some women. The Lost Vikings was another big title that they did that came out in 1994. 1994 was a big year for Blizzard, and that game won the best puzzle game of the year. And Lost Vikings were about these three Vikings who were abducted in a spaceship, and they have to solve these puzzles. And
sounds like everything you would want.
It sounds like everything. It's so silly, but so cool. And you can actually see little Easter eggs for Lost Vikings in Overwatch.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's little arcade games that are
the
Lost Vikings.
I love that stuff.
Keep in mind that Blizzard had only 20 people in their company at this time, and they were beating out these much larger video game companies like Nintendo and Konami for these Best Games of the Year awards.
But they were working with Nintendo, weren't they?
They weren't working with Nintendo. They were working with Interplay, who was like a bigger video game studio that Nintendo would hire and that Interplay would farm stuff out.
Okay.
But they were still beating these other big manufacturers with a really small company. And despite all their awards, the company constantly seemed on the edge of a cliff as far as like bankruptcy goes. Like, they were living check to check. And Mike and Alan, the two heads of the company, pride themselves on never missing payroll, which is a feat they accomplished at times by going to supermarkets with their credit cards and taking out as much cash advances as they could at the supermarket, and then depositing that money into their payroll account to make sure that their employees were still getting paid.
That is really cool.
And just racking up the debt.
I know companies that definitely miss payroll.
Yeah. And that's what a lot of the guys who worked for Blizzard in the early days, they said, you know, Mike and Alan didn't talk about this, but eventually it kind of found out what they were doing, and people were like, we would work for these guys forever.
Do they still work for them?
Some of them do, yeah. But, you know, these are companies start in 1991. You know, it's over 20 years ago now.
Guess you can't stay forever.
Yeah, I can't stay forever. It was also in 1994 that they solved their money problems by selling themselves to a larger company, as you do. But they were bought by a PC distribution company called Davidson & Associates. And Davidson & Associates are famous for...
Sounds like lawyers.
It does. Well, they're famous for creating learning games. Like, they created Math Blaster.
Oh.
Yeah. And Interplay...
Now Math Blaster comes with rock and roll soundtrack.
With a new rock and roll soundtrack. Interplay, the company that they were working for, Blizzard, also offered to buy them. And Blizzard almost went with Interplay, but Davidson and Associates were like, look, if you let us buy you, we're not going to touch anything you do. You're just going to, you know, make whatever games you want. And they were like, that freedom is really enticing.
That is... I feel like that's the dream.
Yeah.
To have all the money... And do whatever you want.
To have the means and the artistic freedom, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also in 1994, once again, this is, like I said, big year for Blizzard, they changed the name from Silicon and Synapse to Blizzard Entertainment.
Better name.
Yeah, much better. Silicon and Synapse, apparently, when they would talk to people, people thought that they were like a breast augmentation company.
That's what I thought, too.
Because, no, I mean, I feel like nowadays it's common knowledge that Silicon is, you know, Silicon Valley is one of the building blocks of computer cells, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, but my first thought is always breast enhancements.
That's my first thought as well.
Funny.
So Blizzard went on to create hit games left and right. You know, they started the Diablo franchise in 1996. They started the Warcraft franchise in 1994, but that really took off in 1996 with Warcraft 2. They started the Starcraft franchise in 1998, and they've really been hitting it out of the park since. And
those are all computer games, weren't they?
Those are all computer games, yeah. Because
I played computers a lot, and I remember those games. I didn't play them, but I remember them being a presence.
The amount of hours of my life lost to Diablo and Diablo 2 and StarCraft is embarrassing. I don't even want people to know.
Did they record the hours like Steam does?
No. This is before that. Okay. This is before that.
There's a service called Steam that we use to play... a certain game called Civ 5, and it tells you how many hours you've played.
Yeah.
And I think it's just shaming
you. It shames you. It's like, do you really realize how long you've been playing these games? And Blizzard also has been known, was especially known in the 90s for this, but for their cinematics. They had the best cinematics, like, in the business.
What are cinematics exactly?
These cut scenes that would kind of flesh out the story of the game. Like watching a Pixar movie, not quite as...
Right.
Well animated, or, you know, it's not cutesy a lot of times.
It expands the plot.
Yeah, it expands the plot. That, and that's exactly what it did. These games that maybe didn't have that much of a plot, it gave them so much more of a depth because of these cinematics. And I think it really, to me, adds a lot to the game experience. I'm going to jump past the 2000s, which is, like, really big for Blizzard. It was a big time. This is when World of Warcraft came out. Just because they have so much history, and I can't talk about Blizzard the whole time, and I really want to get to Overwatch, the actual making of Overwatch. But just know that they made a little game called World of Warcraft, and if you haven't heard of any of their other games, I'm sure you've heard of that.
And if you haven't heard of it, you don't play video games.
If you haven't heard of it, I don't know, yeah, where you've been. Even if you don't play video games, I feel like it's such a cultural phenomenon. So Overwatch, the game that we are talking about now. The game of Overwatch was actually born out of the ashes of a scrapped project called Titan. Titan was supposed to be the fresh new IP for Blizzard. It was aiming to be another MMORPG, that's massive multiplayer online role-playing game, like World of Warcraft. But it was supposed to be bigger and better than Blizzard's insanely successful World of Warcraft anyway. Chris Metzen and Jeff Kaplan both worked on World of Warcraft and were brought on to work on Titan. Titan was in production for 7 years before it was finally canceled. And it's a thing, Blizzard doesn't really talk about why or what Titan was, and you don't have any screenshots of it.
Sounds like a dirty secret.
It is a little bit of a dirty secret. They're very tight-lipped about it. Chris Metzen mentions hubris as one of the reasons that Titan got canceled, because they had all been working on WoW. And when Blizzard was like, all right, we're going to do another...
WoW is World of Warcraft.
Yeah, WoW is World of Warcraft. Excuse me. Blizzard was like, all right, we're going to do another big MMORPG. Do you guys want on? They're like, yeah, we could do that again. You know, we knocked this one out of the park. How hard was it? And he's like, we totally forgot. It was insanely hard to make this game. And so that project was completely scrapped, and they were left feeling, you know, really bummed and sad that a lot of people had worked on this game for 7 years and nothing was ever coming out.
I would be so bummed.
Yeah. So the fall of Titan led to the rise of Overwatch and Blizzard's first attempt at a first-person shooter game. Now, for those of you who don't know, a first-person shooter game is where you are controlling a character, but you see what their eyes are seeing, and, you know, you have your gun or whatever. Sometimes it's a melee weapon.
Halo is one of the most famous first-person shooters.
Yeah, it's a very famous first-person shooter. And you run around and you try and kill the enemies. Now, Jeff Kaplan, who worked on Titan, who worked on WoW, and he's the game designer of Overwatch, played a lot of Half-Life and Counter-Strike back in the day. Like, those are the games he really loved playing.
And those are first-person shooter
games. And those are both first-person shooter games. And he wanted to try and make a first-person shooter that captures the fun of those old, original first-person shooter games. And it's a funny thing for Blizzard, because they had never made an FPS before, first-person shooter. They've made these real-time strategy games and these, like, kind of hack-and-slash through your way through dungeons games. And the FPS genre is one of the most flushed-out genres of video games. But Kaplan still felt like he could bring something new to the table of first-person shooters. Or even bring back something old. Kaplan cites the trend of most first-person shooters nowadays to go with this really gritty modern feel, or this, like, very near future feel. You know, you have, like, your AK-47, or you have your slightly more advanced AK-47 that, you know, is, you know, 5 years in the future. So he really wanted to bring kind of like a brighter first-person shooter into the...
Yeah, Overwatch is really bright.
It is.
Fun.
It's a lot more colorful than any of the other first-person shooters that are out there now. He also wanted to bring in more mobility. In first-person shooters nowadays, like, you're pretty much on a plane, you know, you're on the ground, or you can go upstairs of a house, or sometimes there's vehicles and stuff. And he wanted mobility to be a bigger part in Overwatch, his first-person shooter game. And now this idea harkens back to the first-person shooter game Quake, which came out in 1996. And one of the cool things about Quake is that when it was released, it was also released with all the coding and programming with it, and people in the Quake community who were good with computers could modify that game and build stuff in it. They could build maps, they could change the physics engine in it, and it created this game where you could have, like, this modification, this Quake mod, where gravity is halved. So everyone's just jumping around really high.
That is so beyond where I was with my computer games.
Me too. It just seems baffling to me. He mentions in an interview that in the early days of Quake 2, it was a race to see who could build the grappling hook first.
Well, I was just playing the game. I didn't know.
And you could zip around the map. And that's something that's really lost from a lot of modern day first person shooters. Like, it's more focused nowadays on the vehicles you get in, which is cool. Mm-hmm. But he wanted something a little bit more like that old original 90s feel. And that's a huge thing in Overwatch, is the mobility of these characters. Each character is different, and each character has different abilities, and some are more mobile than others. But the maps are very three-dimensional.
You can go all over them.
You can go all over. There's a character, Pharah, who's got a rocket launcher who can just fly. Just flies everywhere.
And rain justice from above.
And she rains justice from above with her rocket launcher. You know, there's a gorilla named Winston who's got a jetpack or a jump pack, and he can just jump around the map. It's really freaking fun. He also is trying to make first-person shooters more team-oriented again. This goes back to the Team Fortress Quake mods.
Yeah, it's funny because first-person makes you think it's just one person.
Yeah. He talks about, you know, when you're in those first-person shooter games and it's a team deathmatch where it's just your team versus the other team, and you're just kind of running around the map, and when you run into one of your a person on your own team, you're like, oh, what are you doing here? And you just kind of leave them. You don't buddy up, really. Whereas in Overwatch, it's highly stressed that you stick together with your team or that you play off each other.
Different characters have different abilities.
Exactly. And a lot, some characters, if they're left out alone, they're just not going to make it, you know? They need support. And you need support from those characters as well. So yeah, it's just a very, very team-based game. Lastly, I just want to mention that the character Tracer, who's my favorite character in the game, was the very first character made and was actually originally from the failed game Titan. They brought her directly over from that game. Overwatch was unveiled at BlizzCon in 2014, and it was in a closed beta from 2015 to 2016, and an open beta in May of 2016.
What's a closed beta?
A closed beta is like a testing phase for only people who are invited to it.
Okay, and then open is for everyone.
Yeah, other people can get in. And as of now, Overwatch has 20 million active players, and it's the fastest selling new intellectual property of all time.
Makes sense.
I don't know how much of this came across, but I love this game. I play it all the time. Claire, what do you think of it?
I am not good with consoles.
Yeah.
And the game that is in my house is on a PlayStation. And I really like the game, and I really want to be good at it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to work. I'm going to pledge to work hard at being better at Overwatch because I want to play with everyone. Because it's so cool, but I'm just not good at it.
Yeah.
I even just play with the computer right now because I'm too embarrassed to go play with real people. Because the way it works is that you're on a team, but you're playing with other people online on this team.
Yeah.
So I can't do that to real people. Like, I can't bring them down with me. So I'm practicing with the computer. And even then, I'm horrible.
Yeah.
I'm so bad. And I'm playing on the easiest setting.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I want to be good. It's so cool. It's such a fun game. And I like watching it played. Like,
yeah.
I actually enjoy sitting and watching people play it.
That's one of the funny things about Overwatch for me is I never really was into first-person shooters at all. I like strategy games and, like, RPG, like, story games. And this Overwatch is so much fun. And it's just so attractive in ways that first-person shooters never really were to me. And just that it's so much brighter. And it's not this dystopian world. Like, it's a world that
it's very hopeful.
It's hopeful. Like,
you're
there's
reuniting.
Definitely problems. There's definitely problems, but it's not this terrible apocalypse or something.
So your favorite character to play with is Tracer?
Tracer. She's this spunky little British girl who can teleport around the map and has machine guns, and she says all these funny, cheeky, very stereotypical lines, like, you know, like, catch you later. And, you know, just got this, like, really Cockney accent. Very yeah. much a caricature.
Also, we should talk about how diverse it is.
Yeah.
Because there are so many different types of characters with so many different abilities. Like, the character that I like best is Symmetra.
Yeah.
And she's this Indian woman who, like, places little, what are
turrets.
They called? Turrets everywhere.
Yeah.
She's a defensive character that holds back the,
yeah.
you know, will shoot at the enemy when she's not there. But so she's available, and then you can be a gorilla, like we talked
yeah,
about.
Yeah, Winston the gorilla mm-hmm. with the jump pack. He's really
you
cool,
too. You can be
too.
A robot.
Yeah.
What's his name?
Bastion.
Bastion.
Yeah. The thing is with this game is that it's a bright, hopeful game, and I think what makes it more attractive to people who don't play first-person shooters are these characters.
Mm-hmm.
Our producer James once mentioned to me that, like, every character in Overwatch looks like they could be the lead role in their own anime. Like, each character is so well designed and well thought out and has a backstory that you kind of only get snippets of. You don't really get told the main backstory for a lot of them. You kind of learn more about these characters through voice lines and interactions that they have with each other in a game.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the point, is that you can get attached to one of them and kind of create your own story. There's a lot of fan fiction around this, too.
Oh, yeah.
And when we were at Comic-Con, the best cosplay was Overwatch.
We're the Overwatch
cosplays.
Because
the characters are so different and so cool.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're, and that's one thing Jeff Kaplan says, that when they're designing the game, when they're making maps, when they're doing anything for the game, designing game modes, he says that the heroes come first, because they're all quote-unquote heroes. The game needs to always be about them as characters more than it is about, like, a cool map or a cool game mode, you know? And I think that shows a lot in Overwatch, and that just that like what we said before, that Blizzard was making these cinematics to these games that kind of like give it a story and a depth. Overwatch has all these different cinematics, these online shorts you can go on and watch and see that give the game and the world so much more depth, and it just makes it a lot more attractive.
We should link to some of those in the Facebook
we
if you want to watch. Because you could just watch them without knowing anything about the game
yeah.
and have a good time. They're really well done.
Yeah, they're like little mini short films, you know.
Good short films. A lot of short films
yeah.
aren't good.
Yeah. And there's this, I saw this video by the PBS channel on YouTube, and it was really good, but it was just this guy talking about one of the reasons that the Overwatch characters are so attractive for fan art and fanfic is because they all have distinctive personalities, but at the same time are still like enough tabula rasa, like blank slate, that you can kind of insert yourself onto them, or you can insert these things that you like onto them.
They really made it possible for the fans to build a world.
Yeah. And it's a very inclusive game. Like, we're talking about these characters, like how diverse they are. They're all different nationalities. There's men and women, old and young.
Questionable sexualities
on some of them. And I think, like, it's funny just how big this game is. And it's a first-person shooter game, and I feel like a lot of it is owed to that like, you can see these characters and be like, oh, I don't really play that kind of game, but I'm curious about these things, because, like, that person looks like me.
Yeah, the fact that I think it's fun.
Yeah.
And I'm not even playing it. I'm like, and I'll watch my boyfriend play it, and I'll ask him to explain, oh, what's going on? Oh, wait, why is that person doing this? And I actually want to know, which, for a Halo, I was never asking those questions.
You didn't care about Master Chief and Cortana and their weird AI her-esque relationship?
No, could not be bothered. I mean, and I think just a funny story for the podcast. This topic wasn't originally on our radar, but it's because Kyle and our producer James just loved this.
We love this game
video game so much that it was kind of like, okay, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
Because so much research had been put in.
Yeah, we'd done a lot of research playing this game. And let me tell you, I don't want anyone to know my ranking. It's embarrassing. And it's just really cool. This game it's been lauded for its portrayal of women, especially, too, because it's not everyone is like the cartoony, giant-breasted comic book girl. There's like all these different body types of people.
No, it is really cool.
Yeah.
A little offensive to Australians, you were saying?
It's a little offensive to Australians, I think. And all different races, too. You know, and one thing that I found out also about this game is that the voice actors for all these characters are of those nationalities that they come from.
Which is a shame that that's actually a thing.
That's a notable thing to be like, oh, you know, it's a Japanese man who does the voice for the Japanese characters.
Yeah, and if you listen to our Kubo and the Two Strings episode.
It was one of the kind of drawbacks of that movie, which was a good movie, but yeah, just a little bit whitewashed. Overwatch is not whitewashed in any respect.
No.
So once again, Blizzard, in my opinion, hits a game out of the park.
It is a really cool game. I completely agree.
Yeah. And in a genre that
and I don't even play it. I don't play it. I do play it. I play it very poorly. I play this game very poorly, and I like it.
And sometimes I wonder how close I am right now in my Overwatch hours to the amount of time I spent in Diablo 2. But
really? It's so new still.
Even so.
Honestly, and we'll update you on Kyle's relationship.
We will. Update. Yeah. That's, oh, God. So anyway, Blizzard, you guys rock and keep up the good work. This is a great game, and I love the representation of people in it. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com. And we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. We would love you like our producer loves Mercy, a character from the game, which is a lot.
He really loves her.
You can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast. I can be found on Twitter at Klex303, that's KLEX303.
I can be found at Along With Claire, that's CLAIRE.
And you can find our producer James at James Fowey Jr. on Twitter, that's James Fowey, FOUHEYJR. You can learn more about Blizzard and Overwatch on our Facebook page, where I'll post that video I mentioned on
post
the PBS channel.
Post everything that we have.
I watched 2-hour-long documentaries, one on Blizzard and one on Overwatch that you can find on YouTube that are well done. So if you're really interested, you can get a lot out of that. Our producer, who loves playing the 19-year-old Korean girl in a mech suit character, Diva is her name, is James Fowey. Diva's the character. James Fowey's the producer. Diva's the producer. James Fowey's the character. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, who would be an amazing Reinhardt. If you ever get this game, Patty, please get it. Be our Reinhardt. Be our shield. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, the Swedish dwarf Torbjorn of our little DSRA podcast. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.